Thank you very much for your introduction. As you have all observed, the list of my characteristics is such that they are completely incompatible. Therefore, I don't exist. nobody could do these things together. Now, tonight, I'm very pleased to come here, invited by very old friends who joined IBM at the same time as I did, to first of all tell you a story, the story of fractal geometry of nature, and secondly, more important perhaps, to show you pictures of members of my family. Well, not my sons, I'm sorry, but my intellectual children, and also some adopted intellectual children. Most of my talk will be in the form of showing you these pictures and then running comment on them if I remember what to say. Now, let me go down and let me immediately go to this first picture. The main point about it is that it is not what you think it is. It is not a photograph. It is not a painting. It was not meant to represent the shape of a planet and the shape of another planet seen from first. Everybody calls it a fractal planet rise. It has become something a classic. It is a mathematical shape. It describes the way in which the world might have looked if some theories of the relief of the Earth that I developed were true. And extraordinary enough, the world does kindly look as what it should look like. The second picture is very different. My family is very large, in fact infinite, and extremely diverse. But you will see gradually that it presents very many close family features. This one, everybody calls him or it or her a dragon. Why a dragon? I don't know, but everybody does. A dragon which overdoes the one which that St. George killed because it has an infinite number of heads or tails or whatever. That's a spatial dragon. This is, well, it's a shape I will explain to you by and by. It was not meant to be a decorative design of some avant-garde style, but came out quite unexpectedly in the midst of the night several years ago when, with the help of an assistant, a course assistant, I was studying what seemed to be a very abstruse and rather ridiculous field of mathematics. And that's another part of it. It is not decorative, it is pure mathematics. Well, pure mathematics is not expected to look like that. Pure mathematics is expected to look very high, very dry and dull, but you will see that's not the case. Well, that's another one of these children of mine. Let me now tell you what they have in common. They have in common a property which distinguishes them from two aspects of geometry you are familiar with. So let me take a situation that prevailed not so many years ago. You had geometry, and geometry was Euclid. Well, in British schools, it was just Euclid. But it was Euclid modified in various ways. That is, shapes of a very great simplicity. Straight lines, circles, ellipses, hyperbolas. All these shapes, if you come closer and look at them in detail, become very boring. They become straight. They defy a tangent. Similarly, you have spheres. When a sphere is looked at in detail, it becomes flat. That's why the Earth was viewed as being flat for so long, justifiably. It looked flat. On the other hand, there is the variety of shape you find in nature, which is exemplified, for example, in a very famous film made by the Eames called Powers of Ten, and the recent book by Morrison's and the Eames also called Powers of Ten. If you take a man lying on a beach and look at him in greater and greater detail, the shapes change in a radical fashion. You see one thing, another thing. There's complete chaos in the variety of shape observed. If you go farther away from the man, the same kind of chaos occurs. Shape change all the time. Look now, for example, at a ball of thread at some distance. Far enough, it's a point. Closer, it's a ball. Closer, it's a collection of wires, of lines. Closer still, a collection of cylinders. It changes as you look at it back and forth. Well, between that complete and, in a way, cold order of classical geometry and the chaos, the infinite possibilities of the rest of the world around us, I have been fortunate in finding an orderly region, of mapping a region of ordering chaos. And this ordering chaos is exemplified by the fact that if you look in increasing detail at the shapes I'm interested in, and which I label fractals, they change in many ways, but they remain essentially alike. Now look first of all at this landscape seen from the zenith. It's completely artificial, I hasten to say. It's just a complete forgery of nature. The fact you see a man's face in profile there is not meant to be there. It just happens to be often there. These shapes very often have anthropomorphic features like ordinary actual relief has or clouds have. Now you see this white rectangle there. Let us come closer and closer and closer. As we come on closer, you see that the landscape changes, but it does not change in a fashion which goes out from a collection of brothers and sisters. They are siblings, they are all the same family. They are identical from a viewpoint of certain characteristics of a generic nature. Now, I hasten to say that all these pictures of landscapes, and you will see at the beginning, are due to a friend of mine, Richard Voss. I am perhaps singular also in the fact that I work in a computer company and I make extraordinary use of computers, but I don't know how to program. Therefore, I depend entirely upon assistants and upon associates, and assistants are too numerous to be named, but I would like to name Richard Voss as having been the author of many of these things. Now you go further and further, and you find again that these things change, but don't change radically. At this point, when I stop, here you are going to have moved the thing bigger in the ratio of 20 million. Now, these pictures are part of a film that we have done, and that film I didn't bring because it's a bit cumbersome. It takes time, and also because many people are quite uncomfortable seeing it, and this room does not have seat belts. They think they're falling in. They are becoming smaller, and it's quite scary. So here is the criterion, as I say, of self-similarity. It's called self-similarity because the parts are the same as the whole. This, I skip this one. Let me come to this picture as a reminder to me to point out one interesting characteristic of self-similarity, which is that if you try to measure the coastline of that imaginary universe on the succession of pictures I showed you, obviously, each time you come closer, you see more details, more bays, more anfractuosities, and the length increases. Therefore, the very simple idea of length of a coastline, which seems to be so obvious as to be without any problem, turns out, in fact, to just flow away between your fingers. There is no such thing as length of a coastline. A coastline's length depends upon who measures it and why. A giant with 70 league stride would measure a shorter coastline here around the Puget Sound than somebody with simply 7 league steps or ordinary steps. As you look closer and closer, the length increases. And that's very important. The influence of, ideology upon the way you look at the world is very well known. In this particular case, the fact that anybody should have been bothered by the fact that length is not something well defined for coastlines came to me as a very great shock and surprise about 20 years ago when I started peddling this idea. Of course, now it is an obvious fact. Now, let me describe to you one of my adopted children. Adopted because it existed before fractals existed. Matter of fact, it existed well before I was born. It's a curve called the snowflake curve. Now, in order for a shape to be self-similar, described before, it must have details of every size. Before, it was done by cute ways, which I have not described. Now, I'm going to tell you how to put in details by hand. You start with a straight line. You add up this pyramid, yet another pyramid, another pyramid, yet another. And each time you add pyramids, the length is increased all the time. At the end, if you go indefinitely, you get this shape, which has been called the snowflake curve. Its inventor was a Swede named Helge van Koch, and I like to very much to preserve the names of people who have worked on these things in the past. Therefore, I prefer to call it the Koch curve. In New York, of course, it's called the Koch curve. Now, what do we do with Koch curve? This slide is upside down by design. How do we, because I don't want you to read it, I want just to remind me to mention to you that there is a whole mathematical theory about that. I say that the coastlines are infinite, but, well, people are equal, but some are more equal than others, as well known, and curves have infinite length, and some are more infinite than others. So you must measure this infinitude of curves. Surfaces are rough, and some are rougher than others, therefore have more detail. And a measurement that we found for it. Now, bodies, some bodies are cold, others are hot. And there is a number called temperature to measure the difference of hotness between shapes, between bodies. In the same fashion, there is a number called fractal dimension, which measures the roughness of surfaces, the degree of infinity, if you will, of the coastlines, the different parts of the world, et cetera, et cetera. This number is called the fractal dimension. Now, I would just like to mention it's a fraction. For the snowflake curve you saw before, it is equal to 1 1/4. You see, dimension for ordinary shapes, dimension for Euclid, is always an integer. A point has dimension 0, a line dimension 1, a square dimension 2, a cube dimension 3, etc. And here we deal with shapes whose dimensions are fractions. For example, again, the snowflake curve dimension 1 1/4. Here we see from outside going in shapes of increasing wiggliness and of increasing dimension. Now you may say, why this number? Why not another number? Well, it just happens that this number is the right measure of roughness for many reasons. Besides, it happens to fulfill a very essential understanding we have about what roughness is. And that I am experiencing very often with people who become experienced with fractals. After a while, they can guess dimension quite exactly. On one notable occasion, a friend brought to us a fractal hadron that we did not know. And my assistant said, well, was asked to guess dimension 1.2 or something. And somebody else was standing there said, well, 1.8, just to be different. And I said, it's a little bit short of 1.5. And it was 1.48. So you see, by just looking at something, I can tell these things rather precisely. And I think it is something one learns rather rapidly. Besides, if you want to measure roughness for purpose of science, that's what you need. And I would like to mention that fact very strongly, because that is a very essential aspect, that the dimension is something which happens to be the right measurement of roughness if you do want to do physics on these things. Fractals is not only a qualitative way of looking at things. It is a qualitative way. It is a philosophical outlook on the shape of the world, and it's very effective as such. But it is also a quantitative way of looking at the world. It can make quantitative, numerical things which before were very intuitive, like being hot or cold, or rough or smooth. Now, speaking of dimension, you'd say, what about dimension? How big a dimension a curve can be? Well, a curve can be any dimension between 1 and 2. Now, dimension 1, we know them. They are straight lines. Dimension 2, how can a curve be of dimension 2? How can a curve pretend to be something which only the plane is? Well, I'm going to show you how. So you begin by taking a straight line, which is the bottom of the triangle on top. You replace it by this wiggly thing. Then you repeat on each of the sides the same wiggly construction. Then you get this. Well, let me skip this one. You get this after a while. Then you get this after a while. And you very well perceive that if it went on forever, this thing is going to wiggle so well and so effectively, that's going to fill in a shape which, lo and behold, is precisely the Koch curve. So this is called the snowflake sweep curve. It is one that I designed, but it is according to the pattern which was started by an Italian mathematician named Giuseppe Peano in 1890. Now, Peano was a very strange man. He was very, very, very close to the idea that everybody has of how strange a mathematician can be. He obliged with a vengeance. Now, he believed that the languages of the world were not good enough, and Esperanto and so on not good enough for him either. So he invented his own universal language, which he alone knew, but still he called universal language. And many of papers of Peano are written in this universal language. He was a man of extraordinary achievements, but also, well, while Peano was the object of derision on the part of many great men of the time, in particular, a very great man of the time was Henri Poincaré. He was probably the greatest scientist of the period, mathematician, physicist, and everything. And in one of his most memorable and least fair articles, he described the work of Peano and said that Monsieur Peano wants to explain to us what unity is. And in his words, I quote Peano, one equals and then follows an extraordinarily complicated formula. And Poincaré says, well, everybody will agree that they have learned a great deal about one by looking at this formula. Well, that made Peano look like completely out of it. And somehow, this idea of a curve that has the absurd pretension of filling the plane was taken by many people as the beginning of something. The beginning of a separation between mathematics and physics. And it's something which I, both as a person in my life and philosophically, find one of the most important issues that bother me. I don't think there is a difference between mathematics and physics. When I gave this list to the chairman, jokingly, I didn't know he would repeat it tonight, of the fields I'm in, I don't view them as being separate fields. For me, all these things are a seamless continuum in which one goes from mathematics into physics and into other things without realizing one crosses the border. There are no custom stations are there. But people took Peano's discovery as being the beginning of independence of mathematics with respect to science. Mathematics could be separated because Peano curve, a curve that fills the plane, was something which was just completely foreign to experience and totally absurd. And that was said by many people, including some of my dearest teachers, and I remind them of it very often. Now, to ascertain the validity of this claim, let's look at this picture, which is very similar to the previous one, except that the corners were rounded. And depending upon who you are, many things can be seen here. Bushes growing on a tree, or perhaps flames, or perhaps a nightmare, or perhaps a dream, or perhaps rivers. You could very well think of that as being a network of rivers around in various directions. And that is very, very simple. Now I've spoken with children. I have friends, my friends speak to their children because it had to be a double blind situation, which to try to ask to them what would happen if somebody, an explorer, would to land a new land on the wrong side of an estuary. He wants to go other side, but his boat is sunk, has sunk. He must go up and up and up. There's no map. He's going to follow all the rivers going up, and you make up a story. What will happen? He will come very close to every point of the country because there is a river very close to every point of the country. Therefore, the idea of a space-filling curve, which was so extraordinarily revolutionary and was taken as the beginning of the separation of pure mathematics from physics in 1890, in fact was based upon just plain stupidity, or more precisely, plain blindness. It was based upon the fact that nobody bothered to draw these pictures because it was understood that they were completely meaningless, they had no relevance to science, to reality, to physics, to the world around us, therefore they did not have to be drawn. And my dear uncle, whose name was referred to, who was a man I liked very much, to the end of his life, was bothered by the fact that I would just pretend to represent the shapes of mathematics, whereas in fact they had to be abstract and mental. Now, let's come back to the shapes of mountains which I obtained by putting together this idea I sketched. I gave you a little bit of the philosophy behind fractals. Let me show you a bit of proof of the pudding. That was the beginning of the proof of pudding. This came out in 1974. It figured in my book in 1975, and then it was very fresh. At that time, computer graphics did not exist. So these pictures were made by a very, very complicated system which took, well, many people, nobody knew how it worked really, but by and large, it worked rather it worked well, so we just used it. And then at the end, the pictures were shown on a laboratory CRT, cathode ray tube, and photographed just of the tube. And this example of it. Now, when you saw that, we're amazed, because this looked very much like something from a travelogue. At least we had such a low expectations that this looked very realistic indeed. And they were the first pictures of fractal mountains anybody would have seen. They were my old book. They are still a new book because I've gotten used to them. These are the pictures in a more recent one, the 77 book, which, well, they were better, but that's long ago. And here is what we can do now. This is a complete fake. This is not a photograph. This is not a painting. This is the result of a computer program embodying my theory of the relief of the Earth, and later on, of course, processed by an extraordinary programmer who understand to, and the colors, of course, are added again by the computer. When we showed this picture first to a group of people from Hollywood, and you know very soon why I bothered to show them Hollywood, they stood up and asked, by which kind of special effect did you get this fog effect in the bottom on the lake? And the answer was an extraordinary special effect. It is called physics. Because the reflection of light in this fog is just what absorption of light would be in the case of clouds, so on. This is a different landscape. And now you see how it looks like. Let me look them, show them again next to each other. Here is this one, and here is this one. They are sort of the same, but this one is rougher, has more little hillocks on top of it. And this one here has even more. And so what was changed is just one number in the program which generated these pictures, and that number is the fractal dimension told before. So now, if you look at this picture for a while, you get accustomed, your body gets calibrated to that, your mind gets calibrated, and you can tell with quite high precision what dimension is, even without measuring it. If you measure it, you find the thing that you guessed. So it's beautiful. Now, what is this next one? Slight modification of the algorithm. What is this one? A different modification. Now, these pictures I showed you now in a slightly more less advanced form appeared in the book to which the chairman has referred. These are our latest version, therefore they are more refined and more. I don't know. Is it in focus? I cannot see. Is it in focus? No. Well, if it's in focus, it's much nicer. Well, let me talk anyhow while it's being focused. Now, a geomorphologist friend of mine has been taking this picture and preceding one and using them very widely to, as examples of what the effects of various tectonic mechanisms and erosion and so on are. But he knows they're fakes. But still, he finds them to be very, very effective for this purpose. Now, the next picture, same landscape a little bit later in the season. This is a fake. That's pure mathematics plus computer graphics. That's when there's a relief on the moon in the spring when the flowers come out. That is a very rough surface. Well, the focus seems to be rather unstable, but it's a surface seen from a distance. And that is just a reminder to tell you, to show about this thing, which is also a curve which is upside down, because I would like to point out the practicalness of that. And why do I want to bother you about practicalness? Because maybe you don't care about it. Because I want to underline the seamlessness which exists between the most abstract things that I have been doing and some things which are of a completely hard and practical nature. This is a matter of hardness of metals. You can have a certain kind of metal, heat treat it in various ways, measure the fractal dimension of the break, and then measure the toughness of the metal. And this curve, which is sort of straight, gives you a relation between roughness and toughness. Now, such a relation had to exist because, well, it's obvious, roughness and toughness had to be related. But to be so simple was very surprising, and more surprising fact is that roughness could be measured reliably and repeatedly. This picture is not ours. It is due to the staff of Lucasfilm, and it's taken from a film called The Wrath of Khan Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. It's a film which I saw in the course of duty after The day after we saw it, I submit to IBM an expense account in which my ticket stub was enclosed, and so I went on work to watch them in their in showing how they use the fractal landscapes. Because fractal landscapes, these techniques have become routine in Hollywood in that kind of thing. On my flying from New York to Seattle last week, I saw the next film of the sort, which is Last Starfighter, again for free. But the fact that these films are not very good in terms of computer of mountains is very interesting. It's very exciting that this idea, again, which not so long ago was so abstract and removed. I mean, my first papers on this stuff were uniformly refused by every journal. I mean, the reason why I wrote this first French book was because the only way to have my things published was something like vanity publishing of sort. But that the reason why it became so popular, that's something very exciting. But there's something else which is very exciting, that the people at Lucasfilm made a mistake. They took a shortcut which was not the right one. We know many good shortcuts, because the ways we do these landscapes you saw before are on the expensive side. If you do one or two or three or four and work at IBM, it's all right. But if you want to do them by the million, it's much harder. So this, people took shortcuts. But now look at this thing. I can't point out, and I don't have a marker. But you see this kind of V at the bottom of it, like folds? You see the fact that this kind of crumpled paper effect? The fact that the moon is not round is irrelevant. Forget that. That's strange, but I understand it. But that's something else. That's not fractal. The fact that these effects of crumpled and thank you very much. This effect of crumpled paper here, folded paper and crumpled paper, these effects are an inevitable part of this algorithm. Now, again, I'm enchanted that's used. But the idea of this algorithm was one which I discussed with one of my teachers in Paris when I first told him that these surfaces should be suitable as models of relief. So he was very surprised. He said, "How do you know?" I say, "Well, I don't know. I have a mental picture of them. I think they should work." Well, the mental picture was enough, and we discussed the matter, how would you go around to construct it. And we said it would be nice if it could be constructed this way, but of course you cannot. Because what's failing here is not just that they took a shortcut. By taking a shortcut, they destroyed this self-similarity, which I showed before. It is not true on these pictures that are coming closer and closer and closer, you get the same thing. It changes depending upon where you sit. Now, I'm not bored with details. These surfaces are fractal surfaces, but they're what's called non-stationary fractal surfaces. They are defective in their self-similarity. And when I first pointed out to Lucasfilm people that self-similarity was destroyed, they say, "Well, so what? What tells you that the world is self-similar?" And I don't know what tells me that. But I know that if the things are self-similar, they look right. If they are not, they don't. That's our thing for contrast. Well, that's, again, Lucasfilm things seen from high up. And you see those folds. Those things here, that is due to the same effect. It cannot be taken away. But that is just to show you by playing with the different shortcuts, you can get different texture. That's easy. That's just a mistake. Now we go from mountains to clouds. So I'm going to tell you how to imitate the mountains and the clouds. Now here, a cloud, again, a shape in space which is a bit too blunt to be a cloud, of very high dimension. Here dimension is 2.5, and here dimension is 2 1/3. Again, I know these dimensions, and I recognize them. These things don't really look like clouds. However, they behave like clouds. And a student of mine, Sean Lovejoy, who is a meteorologist, in fact, a Canadian meteorologist, even though presently in France, has tested on data about clouds whether this model applies, and has found consistently that the contour of clouds as seen from the zenith are fractal with dimension approximately 4/3 of a range of values which goes from less than square kilometer to over 1 million square kilometers. That's all there is for clouds. There is no rule in meteorology that remotely resembles this one in terms of the width application. But let us look at this thing a little bit better under some Wait a minute, what's happening there? Mystery. Oh yes, thank you. So here are the surfaces in which, instead of having these blunt things, they have been softened. And softened how? You imagine that there is something called opaqueness. And the inside is a cloud completely opaque, outside is completely non-opaque. In between, it's of varying opaqueness. And if you have these things between, and if you have the right technique, and know the computer like Dick does, you get that. So these are completely fake clouds. This one is on a checkerboard, and this one is on the moon. Well, these clouds are very nice. In fact, they were very pleasing because when we showed them to, again, the same Hollywood people, they said, by which special effect did you get that? And we say self-similarity, fractals, stationarity, everything. And you just mix, and I get that. But there's a trouble with that, clouds are of great variety. I didn't go into details of how we could improve the mountains, because we can. But all right, let me show how to improve the clouds. Sometimes you have a cloud which is just one hand on the sky, otherwise clear, like in a story in the Bible. And sometimes the cloud covers the whole sky, and sometimes they cover the whole sky almost completely, with gaps in between. And that is something which has to be accounted for. And that is something which I accounted for by introducing another number. Again, measuring shape. And that number I called lacunarity. So there is something called fractal dimension, which measures one aspect of shape, and then a premium, something called lacunarity. So the previous thing was a very lacunar, very big hole. This one is more a picture of a rain area with rain front moving on. And that fooled many meteorologists. And this one is a rather low lacunarity cloud. And let me show now a series of pictures of this thing going on. So the pictures depict what happens as the cloud is processed, pushed by wind, big eddies, small eddies. And so the same cloud at different points in time. I think I didn't put them in the right order, but that's all right. It's roughly right. You see very well that's how clouds change, except you have to sort of follow the cloud in the sky. I forgot how many I put there, it's quite a lot. Oh well, so we can do it. And that again is by theory. These pictures of clouds are by Sean Lovejoy and myself. And this last one is that you can also have stratification. Like if you fly in an airplane, you see clouds, they're not bulky, but you see them off the side. And that is work which is done by Lovejoy and Scherzer using my techniques generalized suitably. So I can imitate the clouds and the mountains and many other such things. What else can I do? Well, I can also create wild shapes. Wild and wonderful and new and very rapidly very familiar ones. And you remember now how the Koch curve was constructed. You take something simple and you make it more and more complicated by adding detail. So here you start with a circle, which I forgot to put in, and you put these shapes one after the other. And at the end of many operations, you obtain something which is like that. Now you do it differently. You get a different number, you get this, then this, then this. So you see, each of these series has a different sequence of shapes and different limit. It turns out that these two series are constructed by the same formula, except for a number. There's a certain formula which takes exactly one half line to write. You must understand the meaning of some symbols, but really it's a very simple formula. But of course, I will not write it now because it's too late and in the wrong place. But a very simple formula, which is repeated, you can obtain these things. And the repetition is the key of the matter. Because coming back to Euclid, the reason why Euclid's shapes are simple is that by and large, they're constructed in one swoop. You go through it, it's constructed, it's it. And all the fractal shapes involve a loop in the program. You finish something, you start again, you finish something, you start again. You finish one level of precision, you add more detail. And the question arises, what kind of shapes can be obtained by this very simple formula? Pardon. And I'm going to give you a few examples. Now, again, I don't want to write the formula, but let me say for those who can understand formulas upon just mentioning by in words, you start in a complex plane, you pick a complex number mu, and for each point z, you replace it by z squared minus mu. Then with the result, again, you get z squared minus mu. Again, this repeat endlessly. So just a quadratic map in the complex plane. It involves a squaring and a subtraction. There is almost nothing simpler than that. It's the most elementary formula I could imagine. There is not much you can get out of squaring, I thought. But wait a minute, I'll show you what you can get from squaring. This shape here is not the trademark of a well-known oil company. It's obtained by squaring with suitable parameter. That is, if you start, this is the plane, if you start from outside, imagine a ball rolling according to certain rules of mechanics, the ball is going to roll down and then continue rolling on this very wiggly shape. If it's inside, it's going to roll out. So shape is what's called an attractor. It's also sometimes called a repeller because sometimes people like to look forward and sometimes people like to look backward, but same thing. So it's an attractor repeller, and it's what's called a strange attractor and what may be called a fractal attractor. This one here I nicknamed one day the San Marco shape. The reason is that, as you may know perhaps, in Venice, Basilica of San Marco has three marvelous cupolas, and the waters often go very high. Imagine a horrible day where the waters come to the thing here. That's the reflection. And the rest is, of course, a mad mathematician's extrapolation, because mad mathematicians cannot stop at three cupolas. They need an infinity. It's either one infinity. Anyhow, all these shapes are obtained by this very simple formula. This shape here you saw early is obtained this fashion. And again, the colors here, the colors themselves are artificial, but the pattern of color is very important. There are 26 colors, black and 5 times 5 otherwise, and these colors, they had to be in that number because this shape has something fundamental to it, which is precisely having this 25 colors. So then we go ahead further. This is, again, a different dragon for a different number. You change a number, and you get these different numbers. This one, of course, everybody calls a young anorexic lady dragon. That's a lady dragon dressed for a ball, for a party. That's a dragon's tail, a different dragon's tail. Well, not a dragon. A piece of a dragon, details. Other piece of dragon. Again, piece of dragon. You notice that very often these dragons have logarithmic spirals. And when I say to people that Euclid is something which becomes boring, and then fractals are what remains the same, there's always somebody at the end who stands up and says, what about logarithmic spirals? So let me say it before you ask. Logarithmic spirals have the property that if you sit exactly in the center, it is true that if you look at them closer and closer, they're the same. But any other piece is otherwise. So fractals are in a way like logarithmic spirals everywhere. They have little loops all over the place. Well, let me show some my dragon gallery, a fat dragon that hasn't reduced a bit. That's a dragon's coat. Memorable night about 5 years ago, was to sit down and try to find a criterion of how these dragons are going to look like. I'm going to make a shape, a map, which will tell me from now in future how they're going to look like. I would also add something here, which I forgot to say. When I say that science is seamless, science is also seamless historically. Science is something which is very, very old and very, very new. And it turns out that the parts of science in which I have particular interest very often have had several lives. one life 100 years ago, followed by a long period of nothing, and then a revival, and then a burst of activity. The theory I'm now studying here, the theory of iteration of rational functions, saw its heyday. It started in 1870. The first important paper otherwise was the late 1800s, then 1906, 1917. Then it fell in a long slumber. And as one of the papers describing the history of the subject says, it was in slumber until it was kissed back to life by... So you see, I'm in a very extraordinary position of, at my age, playing Prince Charming, and my wife is not jealous. So here's the map which I drew, and it's called the M set, or Mandelbrot set. Here is another way of drawing it. No, pardon, let's go back to the previous one. So you see this map, I forgot the sequence of things. This map, this slide is not exactly clean, because as many of the slides coming around and so on, and I've been looking for a long time, so I can tell you about what, which uncleanness comes from what. So this is just dirt. This is dirt, 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 this is dirt. But what about this? Well, here it is. So some pieces of dirt are not pieces of dirt. They are real things. And if you took this little thing here and blew it up, you'll find, again, something very much like what I had before, or this one. It's a shape which has this, in itself, extraordinary, again, repetitive structure. There's a whole thing and smaller pieces and so on ad infinitum. Here is how it's built. And you begin to see it's rather more interesting if you see it in this fashion than before. Now you realize that this thing was real, this was real, and here this was just dirt. And you are not surprised about it. Now let's look at it again further. That is the little piece of dirt seen in detail. So you see, the little piece of dirt and the other piece of dirt there, they are linked to each other by a kind of very strange network. Well, that is something I have no time to explain, so I will just jump over that. Let me jump over that because I'm running behind. If you look at a different corner of that M set, you find this strange network. Very different. Before, there were things going out and branching into two, and here they go out and branch into 11s. I know that because I counted them. And also because that's what I looked for. If this thing were looked in greater detail, it will again focus up and become one of these little shapes. Well, shapes with which I have the honor of sharing the name. That's, again, some pictures of it. As you come and look at smaller and smaller of these things, they become more and more hairy. You see this one? It's closer, and all that is just a little corner of a big space. The shape itself looked fairly boring, this strange, this cardioid-shaped thing in sort of circles at first sight, and then the dirt. But then you begin to focus. Something very interesting is happening. It is not quite what I said before about fractals, that remain the same as you look closer. They became better as you look closer. They become more and more complicated, richer and richer in structure. And here's an example of it. You saw it already before. This piece here is not, again, a pastel design of a late period in pastel Scotland, but a piece of the M set. Now, let's look at it in greater detail. Let's look at this piece in greater detail. You get this. Now, so you see, that's a map in the parameter plane. And then we're going to go back to the map in the attractor, you get that. So you go one plane to the other, and the two look very much alike. And so in a certain sense, what happens is that this set, the M set, has two roles. On the one hand, it's a numerical map. You see the points, X and Y, on this parameter plane, and you can guess by following the rules I discovered, and now dozens of very brilliant people have worked on it. These rules are very well known. There are thousands of pages of text written about it. It has become a very big business. Now, if you follow these rules, you know how the dragon is going to look like, but you don't have to follow the rules. You can just look at this thing because it's also a hieroglyph. The thing here shows you that if you are in a domain where the M set looks like that, then the dragon which is called J-set, looks like that. Then let's look at this in greater detail. That's the top of this thing. Look in further detail, you get that. Now this is, again, just a piece of it. As you come closer and closer, it gets better and better. These color pictures are not mine either. I made them black and white. These are color versions due to Peitgen and Reuter, I think, in Bremen, Germany. And you have already recognized in the middle our old friend, or new friend, friend anyhow. And here is our friend in a better, closer view. And here is our friend's snout in greater view. And of course, that's another of our friends, that another of our friends, etc., etc., etc. But these things here were not drawn to somebody's imagination. They are part of the advanced theory of y equals x squared. Y equals x squared, the Lemaître theory, is nothing. You learn it very early. You think you are through it in freshman college mathematics or earlier. But if you go to next door and next door and next door, doors go on opening again and again, and you get more of them. Now let us move to yet a first next stage, from space, from plane to space. The same transmission z going to z squared, we have done it in more than two dimensions. Not in a plane, but in space. So now we're going to see dragons, which are not dragons in the complex plane, but dragons in the cross-section of a quaternionic plane by a three-dimensional space. If you don't understand, never mind. You will see what they look like. You saw this one. That's a dragon. That is, if you begin to look under it, well, let's look at the next one. Here you see there is this picture here, and you recognize in it one of those dragons seen from side. You remember the dragon which had many colors? So you may wonder, do all these yellow pieces all link together? And if so, how they link together? And that's the answer. They link together in extraordinary complicated fashions. Now, this series of pictures are due to Alan Norton, a colleague of mine, and they are part of research we have carried together over several. That's another example of what is called a domain of attraction. That's another example. This is not old Inca gold. It's just pure mathematics. The advanced theory of z squared. That's also z squared. That's z squared again. That's two domain attraction. Well, mixed together. Now, again, this is something which brings to the most extreme of visualization something which seemed to be either simple and exhausted or complicated and incomprehensible. And that criterion exists all the time in this work. Now let me run very rapidly through a collection of slides because I don't want to explain them in detail. These slides are again what is called Mandelbrot set for various transforms. I put them here just to show you that the shapes you saw before for z squared are also observed for other transformations. So this one is much more complicated, but you recognize again this overall shape. It has here two cusps instead of one, but otherwise very much the same. The same circles with circles before, and then look at this little point there. If you look at it in greater detail, you find whom? Well, obviously, you find him, or it, or whatever. It's a universal shape. It's a shape which has a very great degree of validity. Let us look at other maps. This is not a dish of latest pottery fashion. It's again the J-set of an interesting transform. That's not a fish dish. It's again a J-set. Some other J-sets. All these things are done by simple formulas. That's, of course, a peacock dragon. And other dragons either lying down or standing up. No St. George to slay them. That's results from mistake. We made a mistake, so these things came up. I will come to mistakes very soon, because mistakes are very important. Well, beach balls, actually, it's again, it is not forged iron for some a particular taste, but the J-set, the repeller or the attractor of some transform, a different one. You may wonder want to ask how they obtain these pictures. The color ones, by various means, the landscape with fog requires very advanced equipment. Otherwise, we just couldn't get it. These here are obtained by a very peculiar situation. Once I learned through a friend at IBM that we have inherited a piece of garbage. The piece of garbage was a prototype of a printing machine, which was a big flop. IBM had somewhat designed a machine to for typography. A machine was obviously bad, so it was not constructed, and the prototype was floating around, and this friend, who was a very brilliant programmer, had gotten hold of it and had decided that she was going to make us have a printing machine. And so these black and white pictures are made as machine. Now, Napoleon said that a picture is worth 1,000 words. Now, this picture here is worth 100 million words, because that's how much information it has. The machine does not know it's a picture. The machine thinks it's text, print very, very small letters, black and white, all over this whole thing. So these pictures sometimes can become very complicated. Well, that, I think, are getting close. That is my last picture I'm going to show. And I would like to comment upon it. This picture, like many others see before, is due to mistake. And after living for some time in this fractal world, one gets accustomed to its shapes. And one can guess rather reliably what kind of procedure gets them. It's very rare that people show me shapes which I cannot reasonably circumscribe in origin. But every so often, so if you look at them, they may look beautiful, strange, attractive, or repulsive. Some of them are very terrible. I didn't show the bad ones, because you will have nightmares. But you can find the key. The formula is not too complicated. One way of escaping that is to show only one piece of one of these shapes. Show the whole thing, I could guess the thing. Show me only a piece, very often I couldn't guess the key so readily. But this one was something else, was a mistake. The mistake came up when we were trying to make this picture we saw before. What's happening? Well, okay, I was trying to do this. You remember this picture? This, and then it didn't. Work out, because at that time we had some difficulties with the graphics program. These things now are exercises in books of computer graphics, but when we were doing that, it was quite the avant-garde, the cutting edge. So this thing came out, and when my assistant showed me that thing, I say, hold it, hold it, hold it. It's not what I want, but let's make a print of it first. And I started showing around, and everybody says that this is looks like a very bad German expressionist drawing of 1920s. Now, I don't mind the very bad at all. Voss has also done fractal music. You'd be interested in saying, but I didn't bring any of it. And Chinese say that it sounds like very bad Korean music. And Koreans say it sounds like very bad Chinese music, etc., etc. Forget about the very bad. The point is that by certain formulas, which are quite simple, one gets things that people interpret as being art, even though defective art in this case. We are not trying to make it better, to make better art, because that's not our job. We're not trying to imitate ordinary process of the artist, because we tried. We do an entirely different profession. In each of these cases, I stick to z-squared, not because I'm enamored of squaring. I couldn't care less about squaring as opposed to cubing or something, because squaring is the simplest thing and already gives me what I want. But in these cases, I find that I can obtain a great element of richness out of simple things and more complicated things. But the simple things, which are in a way fundamental, are already very beautiful. Now, this thing here is felt to arouse emotion, that this man has an anguished face, this one has no head, but kept his tie, and this one is being beheaded or something. Anyhow, people see horrible things in that, but it's nothing, it's just gibberish. Now, why does it affect something? Well, I think that there's a very basic reason for it, and to understand this reason, one must go back, well, one can go back into a very dawn of our civilization. One can go back to Greek thinking before the Classic Age. Some of the philosophers of art of that time say that the essence of beauty is lies in symmetry. Now, what they mean by symmetry, they did not mean simply the symmetry between a person and a mirror image. That is school geometry. That is a very simple form of symmetry. What they meant was a kind of harmony between the parts and the whole. That an object to be beautiful must be harmonious. It cannot be completely identical because that's boring. It can't be too orderly. It can't be too chaotic. The parts cannot clash with the whole. It must be in between. Parts must be in agreement with the whole. Now, you have recognized, I'm sure, that precisely the property of fractals, which is that the parts are like the whole, except they are deformed, they are modified, they are somewhat different. This definition of fractals catches and makes systematic one basic aspect of beauty. Therefore, it is not at all surprising that these pictures should be very often confused with art. So, well, I could continue about that. I'm not proposed to speak about goodness and godliness, even though several people often ask me questions. So let me state it, because that some people think that some of these pictures remind them of religious symbols. Ah. Well, maybe they do, but again, they are not that. It's just purely mathematics. So let me again summarize these various threads and bring them together. I wanted to show you, by presenting to you members of my family, and also including some adopted children like the Koch curve, what can be done by studying this family of shapes. One can create a new universe which has this extraordinary property of having two faces. One face which emits the world around us, and one face which creates worlds that, didn't exist. The new worlds, new shapes. Shapes which often look strange at first sight and very rapidly become extremely familiar. Thank you very much.
Dr. Mandelbrot has agreed to answer questions in the usual tradition. If you'd ask understandable questions to me, I'd be grateful.
How are the colors determined?
How do we determine the colors?
Well, it depends entirely upon which picture I'm referring to. In some cases, the colors are purely arbitrary to separate different things. In other cases, like the mountains, the colors are not part of the theory, they're part of nature. They're just part of what we know of the shape of the covering of mountains. At the beginning, we didn't realize that this would be so realistic. So what we did, we had these shapes, wanted to publish them in a more understandable fashion. We took the colors of the London Times and put them on. And then why not? Why do only zeniths? We looked inside, and the effect was rather bad because it was like one of these, some of these haircuts, completely horizontal haircuts. So the algorithm made more complicated. For example, the snow, the thing is white. If a certain function which combines the altitude, the latitude, and the average slope has certain values. So if it's very high and the slope is not too high, you put snow. But if it's very high, but the slope is very, very steep, snow wouldn't hold. You don't put snow. So you don't do it for each point separately. You just try it ahead of time. So it's all part of the program, And these parameters are freely modified. When these two pictures, I put by mistake two pictures of the same valley with different colors, it's because in one it was all white and the other the colors were different. So this is purely for effect. And I must say that I was very hesitant to go to color in this case, because the colors again are not part of the game. We were doing the black and white pictures, which were nice enough, but then the pressure from those guys in Hollywood made us put colors.
Did you understand that, Al? Did you understand that?
It's here and there.
May I repeat the question?
You emphasized very nicely how, as you go in closer and closer to the basic shape, it stays the same. Would you expect that, or maybe it's been done already, that this type of approach would be very useful in, say, studying embryology, where you're looking at developing changes in shape, developing morphology from, small numbers of cells to larger numbers of cells?
You've demonstrated the fact that the shape will stay the same as you go into it or go away from it. Would this be of any use in studying embryology in terms of cellular structure?
Well, embryology in general is too complicated because, again, different organs are different. But take one organ specifically, take the lung. Now, the lung in mammals and many other animals begins by bud, which grows, becomes two buds, and so on. And that's very easy to follow. In fact, trees are, by and large, very good examples of fractals. They have various complications. I didn't show trees, but they can be done better and better. In fact, amazingly well recently by somebody at Boeing. But if you look at the way in which the lung grows, you find that the rules are exactly those fractals. And a very interesting thing happens here. There is a relationship between the size of bronchi after bifurcation and before bifurcation, like two rivers and branches. Now, this relationship was studied by many people, including Darcy Thompson in his famous book on growth and form. On the basis of optimization of saying the world is the best it could be, he determined which shape the bronchi should have in order to minimize the friction of air. Now, that's, in fact, a rather interesting achievement, and it's rather extraordinary that the first idea of that goes back to Euler in the 18th century. But you don't need that, really, because if you take a geometric picture that these buds grow and branch and branch, but are stuck to stay in a finite box, which is the lung, then the constraints of space give you no choice. Only one structure could come out, this particular fractal structure, which happens to be optimal. So the world is the best it could be, because what you're forced to do is the best you should do. If you look at other organs, like, for example, vasculature as opposed to the lungs, the problem is very different. In the lung, there is a box which is entirely devoted to one thing, having a membrane folded over to have a very large area and a very small box, 1 liter or something. But vasculature, as we all know, the veins and arteries must go everywhere. There's very good reference for it. It's Merchant of Venice. There is blood in every piece of flesh. And so, on the other hand, the amount of blood must be very small, because blood is very expensive. It has to be heated, cleaned, etc., etc. And I'm a big man. I must weigh over 100 kilograms, but only 5 kilograms of blood or less. So the blood must be arranged in a special fashion, and then you can go on and develop, in a way, fractal criteria of suitable disposition of vessels in the body, and then lo and behold, you compare it with reality, and it fits. That's too complicated. That is still chaotic.
You could just repeat the questions
so
the whole audience can hear them.
Fine.
Is Dr. Mandelbrot in league with plastic surgeons in terms of predicting the outcome?
Faces are chaotic even when they are properly proportioned. And that's a very important question. Let's compare the criteria of optimality of skin and of the lung. Skin is supposed to keep you, must be as tight as possible, as small area as possible of maximum volume. Well, there are some complications like fingers and nose and so on, but they're in a way stand the way. Otherwise, skin ideally should be like a baby's skin, very tight, and the lungs should be very complicated. So you see, the ideal, what geometry gives you is only two things, a smooth sphere with perfectly smooth skin and the lung. And the face is just something very different. And as you come the face closer and closer, it looks different. Therefore, the face is chaotic. Of course, before plastic surgery, it's worse than chaotic, but that's...
Could we talk about the Koch curve in respect of tangents to the curve?
Well, the Koch curve was constructed by Koch for the purpose of showing that the curve can be very simple and so on, and have no tangent anywhere, and have an infinite length. Now, I didn't dwell on that, but it's indeed true, the Koch curve has no tangent anywhere. And I would like to tell you a story on this account. The idea that the curve, a smooth curve must have a tangent, is of course part of Euclid geometry. As I said, if you look closer and closer and closer, everything becomes straight, and that's called a tangent. And so this idea was very, very strongly entrenched, and a very great man named Ampère went so far as to publish a proof of it. Of course, the proof was wrong. And then in 1872, another very great man named Weierstrass found a counterexample. Now, Weierstrass at that time was a full professor with tenure at the University of Berlin, full member of the Prussian Academy of Sciences, at the very top of the academic ladder. But after having communicated to the academy, who was sleeping, this astounding result, he omitted to publish it because he was afraid of ridicule. So the fact that curve be continuous, have no tangent, was viewed as being quite extraordinary. And the old men whom I asked this question said that old men they knew believed until 1904, when Koch published his curve, that on one occasion the great Weierstrass had made a mistake, and that indeed a curve had to have a tangent. So Koch's purpose was to make the Weierstrass example to replace by something very intuitive and very simple, and that is the curve he constructed. The purpose was that of a counterexample. It served no purpose except to demonstrate that something which people have come to view as obvious was in fact not true. Now, the collection of counterexamples which accumulate in this fashion became quite formidable. And many shapes were drawn between mostly 1875 and 1925, which whole purpose was that. Now, the great Henri Poincaré, whom I mentioned before, had a very negative reaction to counterexamples. He said, in the past, things have become very bad now today. In the past, when people drew new shapes, it was for some purpose, to understand something about nature. But now all these people go around, and all they do is to draw new shapes just to embarrass their colleagues. So these shapes served no purpose except counterexamples. And many of my adopted children were drawn from the camp of the counterexamples of shapes which serve no purpose are in fact quite useful. And that includes, as a matter of fact, the Weierstrass function, which has recently been described by one of my students as being something entirely obvious.
Right at the back. Bearing in mind my emphasis in respect of his unstructured education, which fractal does he consider himself most closely related?
I learned table multiplication up to 5 times 5, and a little bit beyond that. Now, the other thing, I think I'm fractal.
In general.
Yes?
To see shapes.
instructions and set theory, is it worthwhile to try to represent these concretely?
Your introduction to fractals was your God-given gift to see shapes. Now, what was the second part of the question? Did you get that?
Well, yes, I got the question. Now, is it useful to try to represent some very strange... Yes, well, I don't know whether it's possible to do it by representation, but one thing is very clear, is again to come back to my dear ancient friends. 100 years ago, Felix Klein wrote, I seem to be quoting everybody 100 years ago, that mathematicians fall nicely in two categories. Some are more geometers and others are more algebraists, and that you shouldn't force anyone to wear the spots of the other. Now, it has turned out that mathematics was taken over by the algebraists, and they forced the geometers to go underground. I don't like to be underground, so I emerged. Now, don't want the opposite to be true. I leave the algebraists do whatever they please as long as leave me alone.
Yes. The pictures have a resolution. Can you comment on how that's achieved?
Well, the better pictures are done, for example, this landscape on the fog, are done on the machine which is Selco 4000, which is a film recorder done by Constantin Electronic Laboratories, somewhere in New Jersey near where I worked. And the capacity of that machine under the most exacting, specified capacity is 4,000 by 4,000. It can reportedly go to 5,000 by 5,000. We have never gone to 4,000 by 4,000 because A, we couldn't afford the cost of computing, and B, you couldn't see it. So the best pictures are 2,000 by 2,000. A few are a bit above. Some are well below. The fractal planet rise, which involves a little bit of art in sense that we worked very hard at the right lighting and so on to make it look better than it is. The reason was that this was done in 1981 with rather mediocre equipment. That was a matrix film recorder which was taking the signals from a rather good but not extraordinary monitor, and it was a Ramtech frame buffer. It was the spots were not honest, so it said 1,000 by 1,000, but in fact was more like 700 by 700. But so we wanted to make it as good as possible, and we spent lots of time. In fact, Voss was very bored with that. Say, look, let's forget about it. It's going to fly. I say, look, it's going to fly, but let's fly forever, because that thing, if we do it right, is going to stay and to become more and more obsolete. The previous picture, black and white picture, is now quite obsolete, but it's kind of reference of the best can be done in a given time. So that was done by very careful lighting and so on to minimize the defects. The others are completely honest.
Yes? You? Yeah. In addition to the use of fractals in music, have you made use of them in any form of three-dimensional art?
Well, I'm very surprised by you saying that it's not three-dimensional. Mountains are three-dimensional, the clouds are three-dimensional, and those attractors, quaternionic attractors, are three-dimensional. It's very much three-dimensional. I just went rapidly on these things because perhaps I had felt I was running, but many of these things are three-dimensional. In fact, they are four-dimensional, the quaternions, but you can't see them in four dimensions, so you go to three. I think dimension in this sense doesn't matter much, as long as you go beyond one, because in one dimension there's not much to say. In one dimension it's sort of very difficult to plot anything.
So you could show them from different angles?
Oh yes, absolutely. In fact, we have a film in which there's circumnavigation of that thing. In fact, we have stereo pictures, but you can never show them in a large auditorium. These things as I mentioned, in fact, they are just they jump on you. They're stunning. We have films of them rotating in front of you.
I think we'll cut the questions off there, if we may. Thank you very much, Dr. Mandelbrot. Now,
you can sit down. You're going to be finished. You're going to be finished. You can sit down.
I'm going to ask Dr. Paul Gilmore, who's a professor in the Computer Sciences Department at UBC, to thank our speaker. As a point of interest, Dr. Gilmore and Dr. Mandelbrot joined IBM on the same day, some, 15 years ago, was it, Paul?
1958.
And I'm delighted to have you back, Benoit, and be reminded of the manner in which you enlivened my life and the life of many at the Thomas J. Watson Lab with your stories of finding order in the chaos of noise on a telephone line, the chaos of prices on the cotton stock exchange. And seeing you over now 27 years, I've come to the conclusion that you, like some of your fractal curves, become much more interesting as we look at you more closely.
I'll move the meeting adjourned and remind you that we next week, on the 3rd of November, have Professor Zenon Plishan, Director, Center of Cognitive Science at the University of Western Ontario, who will speak to the topic Artificial Intelligence and the Human Mind. Thank you very much and good night.